Hi. Hey, welcome to The Cordial Catholic, a podcast for non-Catholics, new Catholics, and those looking to dig deeper into the Catholic faith. I'm Kay Albert Little, an evangelical, non-denominational convert to Catholicism, and this podcast is born out of one particular idea. See, as I was looking into the deep roots of my faith, into the Catholic Church in particular, I began to realize that almost everything I knew about Catholicism was wrong. It was based on rumors, misinformation, and misunderstandings. This podcast serves to try and fill in those gaps between what you think Catholics believe and what we actually do. We have real Catholic conversations with influential Catholic thinkers from the heart of the Catholic Church. No misinformation here. And today's conversation is a great one. This is, in fact, a topic I've been asked about countless times. I've spent a good long time trying to find just the right guest to tackle it with me. And I think you'll agree we've got one. I'm joined by Jamie Stewart Wolfe to talk about women in the Catholic Church. As a woman in a prominent and influential role in the Catholic publishing world, as a mother and a grandmother, a speaker and a writer, I think you'll find that Jamie does a fantastic job tackling this issue. To try and explain, especially for those outside of the Catholic Church, the role that women play in the life of our faith and why. It's a great conversation. And hey, two things real quick. First, if you're listening to this podcast on iTunes, Spotify, or any other platform or app that allows you to rate and review, please do. Please take a couple of minutes because those ratings and reviews help push this podcast out to new people and to grow the work, the evangelization that's at the heart of the Cordial Catholic. And if you're interested in supporting this work financially, please do consider becoming a patron at patreon.com/cordialcatholic. Even $1 a month allows me to continue to grow this podcast. My heartfelt thank you to those already sponsoring this show and allowing me to make episodes like this one. Without any further ado, please listen and enjoy. Hey friends, welcome back to The Cordial Catholic. My guest this week is Jamie Stewart Wolfe. Jamie is a Catholic convert, an author, musician, and speaker. She writes a regular column for The Pilot, the newspaper for the Archdiocese of Boston. She is a graduate of Harvard University, holds a Master's of Arts in Ministry degree from St. John's Seminary in Boston, and if that wasn't enough, she is the senior editor at Ave Maria Press, one of the top Catholic publishing houses, certainly in North America, maybe the world. Welcome, Jamie. And is it safe to say the world?
The English-speaking world, anyway, right?
I didn't think of rephrasing it that way, but I thought I'd just leave it at the world.
There we go. I mean, we do some Spanish, not tons yet. But, the English-speaking world, I would say so.
Well, I mean, as Anglophones, that's the whole world, right? Especially North American.
And of course, it reaches into a whole lot of places that you wouldn't think are English-speaking, right? So, and a whole lot of people speak English. It's the Greek of our times.
Well, fantastic. Hey, I'm really looking forward to unpacking this this topic with you. And if I think we can jump right into it. And here's what I find kind of interesting about this topic. And this is a bit of my own background here, because as an evangelical Christian, before I became Catholic, I worshiped in a number of different denominations. This might be hard for, say, cradle Catholics to understand. But I drifted through a bunch of different denominational churches, and it wasn't really a big deal to kind of just switch denominations. There was a whole spectrum in these churches of what women did in the churches. There's also kind of a, I want to say, soft limits or barriers. And I'll give you a few examples to help explain this. You know, in one Pentecostal church I attended throughout high school, we had plenty of women on staff, but none of them were called pastors, and none could be on the board of elders. It wasn't something written in our belief statement. It wasn't obvious anywhere. It just was kind of how it was. And in fact, later in my evangelical experience, I went to a church that actually broke away from the Baptists because they thought that they should be allowing women to serve on the elders, and they appointed one. You know, these guidelines, these rules for governing what role women played in these evangelical churches were kind of shadowy sometimes. And it's different for all different kinds of non-denominational evangelical churches, and certainly different in mainline Protestant churches as well. But it does seem to be a stark contrast to the Catholic Church. So I wonder, especially for non-Catholic Christians who might be listening, could you unpack the root of this difference and maybe explain to us a little bit about why the Catholic Church is so definitive when it speaks about women in the church?
You know, the funny thing is that it's definitive because the Catholic Church has a 2,000-year-old reflection, right? An intellectual tradition of knowing the human person through both reason and through the revelation of faith. And it's deeper. The ecclesiology, our understanding of church, is generally deeper than what you'll find in Protestant churches. And I can say that because I, too, am a convert from Protestantism, first from Anglicanism and then evangelical free, which, you know, is kind of a funny thing because it's actually a denomination. But I think I saw similar things to what you saw in my evangelical church as a teenager. Women were allowed to teach women and children. They were not allowed to teach men. And that was kind of rooted in that 1 Timothy writing of St. Paul, where he says, you know, women should be silent, they should be dressed modestly, and never should they teach, should they be over teaching men. And that was, you know, an instruction for the time, but it was also an orientation of the Christian community to what the roles of male and female look like in the order of redemption. And so we're you know, it's a complex thing, right? We understand the human person kind of in three phases. First, in the original way that we were created, created in God's image, called to his likeness, and created as male and female. And then in our fallenness, because of our damaged relationship with God, that really cascades into a disordered set of everything else. It kind of throws us into a distorted view of ourselves, a distorted view of each other, and a distorted view of God. And you can see that even, I mean, we can get more into Genesis, where the fall happens and God kind of metes out consequences, if you would, to the fall. And you see them in actually a very much a male-female kind of way. But then there is the order of redemption. And it's not that God's act in Christ's death on the cross and his resurrection creates the kingdom in its perfection and fullness right here, right now, and immediately. It's that incrementally we become more like him, and we work out our own salvation and our own redemption, and we begin to reflect something that is restored, and not even restored to its original order, but even supersedes by grace the original order that God created when he created us male and female. So it's I would say that the long reflection on the human person and what it means really kind of plays out in how we see men and women. And the biggest difference, I really think, has to do with we talk about male and female, masculine and feminine, not as things we do, but as who we are. And those are very different things. A woman can be a soldier. I mean, we canonize Joan of Arc. A woman can be a doctor. There are a few of those, you know, as well. A woman can be an apostle to the apostles, you know, Mary Magdalene. A woman can be a doctor of the church. A woman can be anything. anything that really matters, right? We all share in the ministries of Christ as prophet, priest, and king, just as originally we shared in equality, male and female, in ruling lordship over the earth, in preserving our image of God as we were created, and in the reproduction of the human race. So we talk a lot. We tend to focus as a culture and a society, and it's in the church as well. You know, it just is kind of naturally about that. We talk about what we do rather than who we are. And one of the great writers on feminism in the Catholic Church, St. Edith Stein, or Teresa Benedicta of the Cross, she's also known as, who died at Auschwitz-Birkenau in 1942, and was a converted Jew, but she'd actually gone through a phase of atheism as well. She talks about the world needs what women are, not what women do. And so that's, I think, the main thing. You know, the church I went to as a teenager, as an evangelical, women, as I said, could teach women, other women and children, Bible studies or prayer groups or whatever. And they could also make coffee. That was pretty much it. You know, there were no youth pastors. And the wife of the pastor seemed to have a role there as well. But the wife of the associate pastor, the wife of the youth minister, but it was different and it was very limited. I know when I came into the Catholic Church, which was more surprising to me than it was to probably anyone else, I discovered that we have a universal call to holiness, and we have a baptism that equips us to be not only made in the image, we're already made in the image of God, but to acquire step by step his likeness, to become more and more like Jesus Christ. And so I used to be very upset by the whole kind of fairness aspect of ordination and all of that stuff. You know, well, why can they and we can't, and that's not fair. And it may not be, quote, fair in terms of if you define fairness as equivalency. But I decided at one point to go back and look at Genesis. And when I finally looked at Genesis, I didn't have a problem with it anymore because I realized that, I could be busy my whole life really working on the baptism part. And once I emptied my baptismal font and really poured my entire life into that Christian life, then maybe we could have a discussion about ordination. But I have yet to exhaust my baptism, and I don't think anyone else has exhausted their baptism either. So it's really not, there are a whole lot of misunderstandings that happen, but it really kind of works at the basis of who is the human person and what does it mean to be male and female.
There's so much in there that I love how you phrase and unpack that. And right away, I feel like you just kind of dropped this bombshell on us when you mentioned that, you know, one of the stark differences, one of the reasons why you see a stark difference is that the Catholic Church has had 2,000 years to reflect on these things when these different denominations that I was a part of and you would have been a part of wouldn't have thought of these things through. They wouldn't have that tradition stretching back to the beginning of the church to help them reflect on these things, right?
Right, exactly. And in some ways, they went very much against church teaching, I mean, Calvin in particular, right? So we have an understanding of humanity as originally good, and God said it was very good, right, in Genesis when he created humanity. We begin with Calvin, with total depravity, that the fallenness of man, his sinfulness, is so great that it overshadows his original goodness. And that's a tremendous difference in just Christian anthropology and the perspectives that flow from that. And that profoundly affects how we view ourselves, how we view one another, and how we view humanity as a whole and human society, even after the redemption. So it's if we begin with total depravity rather than original blessedness, original goodness, we come to a different conclusion.
Yeah, you know, that's fascinating to me, and I hadn't put these things together, but, you know, part of my journey into the Catholic Church was through looking at some of these more emergent social issues around gender and the definition of marriage and these kind of things. And as an evangelical, I didn't have much in my toolkit to help unpack these things. And I was looking at authors who are frequently reinventing the wheel, like trying to look at the same four Bible passages and trying to interpret them in different ways. And when I found the Catholic Church and drew on this enormous tradition of what those kind of things meant, it was just this incredible comforter that, you know, the pearl of great price you talk about finding the Catholic Church. Here I was trying to piece together theology based on the Bible alone and what different theologians said, but then. And this applies, I think, to our understanding of gender and male and female as well. You enter into the Catholic Church, and there's just you're just awash in this great tradition that you were so deprived of before.
Yeah, it's a super rich feast. I mean, I've seen Protestant, you know, excellent, wonderful, beautiful Protestant people do more with the, you know, with the bread and water that they have on their table than we've done with the entire, you know, royal feast that's set before us. And then we should be ashamed of that and inspired by them. But at the same time, it matters. It matters that we have had all this time to reflect and that we inherited such a great wealth of reflection from the Jewish faith. You know, when we inherited the Jewish scriptures, we inherited an amazing treasury of what God had revealed of himself prior to Jesus Christ. And that in and of itself is a magnificent gift. And then to continue that and see its fulfillment in Christ, in the church, is a whole other thing.
All right, so you've already pushed back, I think, very very eloquently and kindly towards the phrasing of my first question, because I did fall into that trap, in a small sense at least, of talking about the role of women. And you've kind of pushed back against that. It's not about what men or women necessarily do, but could you try and unpack a bit of this in as best as we can for how to understand then... you know, I'm going to say the role again, but you know, the place of, because, and you know, I'm trying to understand how to phrase this best, because I think what is seen from the outside sometimes, and I've had this question from a number of non-Catholic Christian listeners as well, women have no role in the church. They have no voice. They have no place. It's a man's world. How would you push back against that?
Well, there are really kind of two aspects of that. The first has to do with do rather than be, right? So if we look at, as soon as we start discussing about what a woman can do or what a man can do, we've missed the point of creation. The creation of male and female is that complementarity that together expresses the God who made us all and who made all of creation. So man, it was not good for man to be alone, because God is one, but he is not alone, right? So he's Trinitarian. The Trinity means that God is love, and that love is within God, and love is God. So we are called to that same kind of love, and it takes complementarity to do that. There has to be an other. Right? There has to be an other, a something other than self, in order for love to even exist. And so really, we're created in love, by love, and for love. And we're created to love the way God does. And that is that we become one. We're so living one life, one existence, one offering, and one complementarity in union, right, that we are like God. That's the call. So that's all about sanctity and the things that are most important. Then when you talk about offices within the church, then we can begin to talk about all kinds of things, teachers and evangelists and people who pray in tongues and speak in tongues and people who interpret those things and people who are administrators and people who are healers and all of that. And then, of course, you know, we gravitate to this whole ordination issue, right? So I guess I don't really feel limited as a woman in the Catholic Church. I have a seminary degree from a Catholic seminary in Boston. I was taught by the same professors who teach priests and took most of the same courses and learned most of the same things. But my ministry as a layperson is to go where a priest cannot go, is to be in the world in a way that a priest can never be in the world, or that even a religious can be in the world, even if they're kind of living in service, they're a teacher or they're a nurse, they're in media, whatever they are, because they're set apart and I'm not. I'm set for mission. And so I'm right in the mission field. The mission field is my home, my family, my neighborhood, my parish, you know, all of that, my job, all of that is mission. And so that's one aspect. But the other aspect is this, and I get the idea of, you know, it's all these, you know, old white men in charge, you know, and there's a lot of resentment that can come with that. I mean, I totally understand that. But at the same time, it's a misapprehension of what priesthood really is meant to be. Because priesthood in the name of Jesus Christ is not power, it's service. And it's leadership by example, not by kind of dominion, right? We have dominion over creation, but holy orders is just simply ordering the holy. And it doesn't mean giving orders. It means just setting things in proper order when it comes to things of the spirit, things of the spiritual life, things of pastoral needs, even, you know. And so ordination, you know, I can be a very active minister. I can teach. I can preach. I can. I just can't celebrate Mass or forgive your sins. That's fine. You know, I'm not missing out, really. And I'm not called to that because my being as a woman is to bring life. The action of the priest is to sacrifice life. So we forget, we kind of look at, as Catholics, our priests are not just pastors, right? They're not just preachers and teachers. Our priests administer the sacraments, and they offer their lives in service to bring the sacraments to us. Sacramental grace being, you know, a sign that signifies what it actually contains, right? So when I receive the Eucharist, it's not just a symbol of those things. It's because the priesthood of Jesus Christ, expressed in the priesthood of the priest, is offering himself in loving union with the entire church for our salvation and the salvation of the world. And so it's not a question of, you know, if we look at the institution of the priesthood, we have to go back to one place. And it's going back to that Last Supper and the washing of the feet. That's the institution of the priesthood, where Jesus said, my priests are like me. They're the master who serves. They're the one who gets on your knees with a towel and a basin and feet and washes the feet of his friends, and some of whom aren't very good friends, right? So it's not a position of power. And I think the last thing we need is more priests, women or men, who think of priesthood as a position of authority and power. It's a position of service. And probably one of the best titles for the Pope in Rome, right, is certainly my favorite, is the servant of the servants of God. Mm-hmm. That's what every priest is called to be. And so if I aspire to priesthood as a leadership and power and sort of the CEO of a parish, I've got it all wrong. I don't even understand priesthood. Priesthood is the last and the lowest and the least, and he's the servant of the servants of God. And so I don't feel like I'm missing out there. It's not a question of who's really in charge. Now, are there instances in which priests could do a better job and bishops could do a better job of listening to the lived experience on the feminine side of humanity? Oh, yes, absolutely. But does that mean we have to be bishops or cardinals or deacons or any of that stuff? No, it doesn't.
That's just a fantastic reframing of that idea of the priest as the servant. And that really turns the whole gig on its head, like you say. I mean, we're, and of course you've mentioned this too, there are certainly priests who see themselves in a position of power and bishops who see themselves in a position of power, and they crave that power, the position for it, its power. But to truly understand the priesthood, as you've unpacked it for us there, as you've rightly unpacked it for us there, is as the role of a servant, serving all these people, men, women, children, everybody in the parish, in the church, that priest is in a role of servitude. And one thing that you said that really struck me right away is you talked about the life of God, this triune God and the Trinity as an expression of love, and then as the complementarity of male and female as an expression of God. And I think that then thinking of the celibate soul male priest just strikes me as kind of a lonely position to be in.
Well, it certainly could be. It certainly could be. And in fact, that's, I think, part of our responsibility as Catholic laity is to befriend priests and to support them with prayer, and also just, you know, to support them with a dinner now and again, or a bowl of chicken soup or whatever it is. But seriously, and not to be afraid of that, not to be afraid to attend to their humanity while they're serving in their own broken and fallen way, just like I do. Right, my brokenness and my fallenness show in how I'm a wife and how I'm not a wife, you know, how I'm a parent and how maybe I've not done so well in some areas with that, and that's just the way it is. But the beauty of Catholic faith is that we understand that the original plan that was then, you know, fallen by original sin, and we have a tendency toward that sin, toward that sinfulness, right? Is redeemed, that we are working out our redemption, that we're on the way to a place where we can be who we truly are. And that's, I think, the primary role of woman, right? Whether you're married, single, religious, not, that you would bring forth in others their true nature, that you would help them develop and become and be and who they really are, who God made them to be, that their talents would be able to be shared, that their needs would be met, that the beautiful thing about mothers, right, is that they know who likes mustard and who doesn't, you know, right? It's those little things. It's those little personal humanizing things. And that's not what generally men are all about. Men are about grand tasks and, you know, and all of that stuff. And I'm not saying that I'm not about some grand tasks too. I can be. But, you know, Joan of Arc certainly was. You know, she's a favorite of mine. But also that we understand that that we're more than what we do.
That's such a fundamental aspect, I think, to underscore, and I appreciate you bringing that around again, because this is the idea, and I think this is the pushback from a lot of people from the outside, who would point to more progressive churches, even mainline churches, who long ago began to ordain women. And you'd look at the tradition of the Catholic Church and say, well, why can't they just change? Why? What is prohibiting them from putting women in these places?
Right. It's just that equal doesn't mean interchangeable, right? It just doesn't mean interchangeable. And the more we create a multiplicity of stereotypes, you know, we have the tomboy and we have the femme fatale and we have the he-man and we have the kind of geek guy or whatever, the more, it doesn't matter how many we create, they're still stereotypes. And to live down to a stereotype is to not live the fullness of who God created every one of us, each one of us as individuals to be. So when I look to the great women of church history, there are many. And when you look to great men of church history, there are many. And the you know, there's great differences between all these women and all these men. You know, somebody like Therese the Little Flower is not like Joan of Arc. And yet Therese loved Joan of Arc, which is kind of ironic, maybe. You know, it's a little funny. There was a very great photographs of her in a Joan of Arc costume, right? But this whole notion that we are what we do is giving into that Enlightenment era utilitarian view of the human person. And that's not Catholic faith. That's not Christian anthropology. I'm not what I do. Thank God I'm not what I do, because I don't do everything all that great all the time. And eventually, in my last dying days, I may not be able to do much of anything at all. This is, you know, it draws into everything, including a consistent life ethic and everything else, that the value of the human person is separate, is higher, is other than what we can do. So, can a woman be a soldier? Absolutely. Can a woman be a doctor? Absolutely. Can can a man be a kindergarten teacher? Absolutely. It isn't what we do that's masculine or feminine. It's how we do it. It's how we do it.
Well, I've been a kindergarten teacher, so I'm glad that I have your affirmation.
But I bet you were a different kind of kindergarten teacher than the one I had.
Yeah.
You know, who was a woman. You were probably a lot more active in that classroom and had those kids moving around a lot more than sit down in your desk and be quiet.
Yeah, it's so interesting. And I think that, I mean, this is a great conversation to have, I think, because the barrier that I'm seeing here is, and I think this is in common with a lot of other aspects of Catholicism, I think that those on the outside, and even maybe new Catholics, or even Catholics who haven't really thought through this part of their faith, might just see this idea of the all-male hierarchy as one of those antiquated rites or rituals or traditions that the Catholic Church does, one of these stagnant, right, kind of leftover things. Did you encounter this as you were approaching the church as a convert?
I did, and I definitely struggled with that whole notion of ordination. And what bothered me more than anything else, I'll tell you the truth, was when I heard someone in the church answer, "Well, you know, Jesus only chose men." And that just really ticked me off, frankly. And it also was very unsatisfying in terms of an answer, right? So for me, that was not an answer, because he also chose Mary and Martha of Bethany, and he also chose Mary Magdalene, and he also chose, you know, Phoebe and Joanna and all these other people that you hear mentioned throughout the scriptures, and he also, above everyone, chose Mary of Nazareth. And this idea that somehow, right, these very raggedy fishermen were somehow better than Mary of Nazareth, we don't teach that. You know, we don't, that's just not even on our radar or on our plate. We don't see it that way at all. But they were chosen for a specific task, and it's not my task. In fact, it definitely isn't my task. Now, if we look at the Holy Trinity, right, we see the Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit, and we see that the Holy Spirit is also called a helper, an advocate. That's what woman is called to be. Woman is called to be a helper, a helpmate, an advocate, right? And if you look at the life of the Blessed Virgin Mary in the scriptures, you see that. She immediately proclaims at the Annunciation, "Behold, the handmaid of the Lord," or bondslave, frankly, of the Lord, right? She's the servant. She's the helper. And yet it's through her that salvation enters the world, and the incarnation, which is the greatest scandal of anything anyone could ever preach in any faith, the greatest challenge to human understanding and the human person, is that God became one of us and everything but sin. You know, that comes through a woman, not a man. In fact, if you go back to the garden, what do you see? They're thrown out of the garden. You know, we ate the fruit from the tree that we were not supposed to eat from. And, you know, she's not technically Eve until they're out of the garden. But the one who falls to the temptation. And yet Adam blames her. You know, he takes the bite of the fruit as well. But, you know, it's her fault. Okay, your responsibility. I've seen that before, you know, and then the blame game goes on. And yet, what is the punishment or the consequences of the fall? It's that man would lord it over woman, right? That we would be subservient, that we would be have our pain multiplied in childbirth. But what is man's punishment or consequence for sin, for falling away from God's will and from obedience and from love, right? It's that he has to really kind of fight for existence, that he's got to earn a living just by a lot of sweat and difficulty and labor. That this beautiful gift of tending a garden and naming the creatures and all of that now becomes a burden. You know, so it's and how do we come back from that? We only come back from that with a last Adam in Jesus Christ and a new Eve in the Blessed Virgin Mary. We come back, even we supersede the original order and become more like God himself, created for complementarity, for oneness, for unity, and for love. It's you could look at the garden, you know, at the sin in the fall of man as a failure to love. He failed to love God, failed to love himself, failed to love his mate. And it's all a failure to love. So what brings us back to love is a God who is love, who enters creation, who becomes one of us, and who redeems all that we are. And it's a beautiful thing. It's a beautiful thing.
That's so well said. Thank you for that. I want to take with you a real stone cold kind of look at the church. And from your vantage point, you've given us a lot to think about here. And, you know, you're a Catholic woman in a position of particular influence, I'd say. And I wonder if we can be honest about some of the challenges that come along with an all-male hierarchy and what might be missing and where some improvements can be made. You know, I don't think either of us intends to overthrow those in leadership, but I think if we're honest, we can just look at what challenges may exist. And I'm going to say in a church that has a largely male perspective in the 21st century, do you see places to improve or places where improvements are already underway, maybe for those that might be concerned?
Oh, sure. I mean, I think the biggest thing is that because sort of men become so task-oriented, we look at the mission of the church in a very corporate, businessy kind of way. And that's not fidelity to the priesthood of Jesus Christ. And it doesn't serve anybody's pastoral needs. You know, we take headcounts and we're worried about the finances and all of that. So, and yes, those are all realities of being in the world. But at the same time, we seem to miss, the institutional church often misses the truth that evangelization is never a program. It's always a person. It's always a humanizing personal relationship with someone. And then bringing them along and inviting them along, it's friendship. And I think that's a feminine perspective that could really help the church in its mission, you know, in her mission to evangelize the world. We don't do that by putting up videos and online programs and degrees and whatever else. That's not how we evangelize. We evangelize by loving each other. And by acknowledging the personhood and humanizing everything around us, right? But I think, too, there are significant pastoral needs that are not really being met. And some of those things have to do, and I think a lot of times a woman who is upset about ordination or a man who's upset about, you know, the whatever's going on in the church and it's never going to be a perfectly wonderful thing, it's going to be sinful. because that's who we are. We're sinners on the way to salvation. But when we get upset by those things, it's often because we have an unmet pastoral need. We haven't been loved. We haven't been served. And I think women especially are attuned to that. And, you know, when someone comes and says, you know, I'm not sure if you'll bury my grandmother because, you know, she hasn't been at the church for so long or whatever. We have to watch how we, this is where the pastoral sense really kind of comes in, you know. What do we do for that family? Is it possible that an event like a death in a family is an evangelical moment? Is that a possibility, a pastoral moment can become something that we draw people back to Christ through our love of them? That's a feminine perspective, I think, you know, that sometimes gets missed. And the whole corporate thing, you know, just this idea of kind of company men and a chain of command and all of that, we overemphasize that. And we miss sometimes the opportunity to really humanize and personalize and attend to people's needs. And sometimes I think that gets missed. And then the other thing is sometimes we do the same thing, and a lot of times we do the same thing with people's gifts. You know, if you ever raise children, you kind of look at them and you see, oh, this one's really good at art, and that one's a dancer, and ooh, this one's, you know, really knows how to do his sums and multiplication tables and whatever, and isn't that great? And you see the gifts in people, and you bring them out, you develop them. And then also you take the weaknesses that you see and you try to bring them along and make them maybe not so weak. That's what a mother does. But that's what the church as mother ought to be doing as well. And finding the gifts in the people who are there and tapping those gifts for the good of the entire community. That's in fact why they were given. And so we don't do a great job of that sometimes. And so it's, you know, if you hear someone in your parish who has a nice voice, you ought to introduce them to the music director and say, you know, rehearsals on Thursday nights. Or if you see somebody who is, you know, just sort of a really attentive person to children, you know, maybe that person could be invited to share that gift in religious education or in sacramental formation of kids, you know. But it's that meeting the needs and making use of the gifts that we don't do a very good job of. But I do think that women could be very helpful in that area.
Well, that's a great point to underscore, I think, for sure. And I mean, I've found, my wife and I, both as converts, have found that sometimes we have to put ourselves forward to get engaged in those parts of the parish, to meet those needs, right, that aren't being met. We have to be the ones that step out and say, hey, you know, we're here, we can do this. Can we be of use in this capacity?
Right. And not everyone kind of has the confidence to do that. Right. So we need to be looking we need to look around us when we go to Mass on Sundays and say, you know, who could I involve? Who could I invite? Who could I, you know, it's like cooking. I think God is a lot like, you know, the way God operates with us is often with his work is a lot like cooking, making cookies with a 4-year-old. You know, you don't really need the 4-year-old there. And in fact, you'll get better cookies if the 4-year-old's not there. But getting better cookies isn't why you cook with a 4-year-old. You know, it's that the 4-year-old learns something. It's that the 4-year-old exercises some motor skills. It's that the 4-year-old is with you and you're doing it together. And it's bonding. And those are the kinds of things we need to do as church. You know, I'm not saying we should all have be making cookies, although, you know, if you let me know what parish has that, I will definitely show up. But those kinds of things where we do things together, maybe even not so well as they could have been done alone. But we do it for the sake of being together. Sometimes it's that. Sometimes it's just that and inviting somebody else. You know, the more people we involve, the better it is.
You know, that's a fantastic perspective. And I wonder, too, if one of the reasons why maybe new Catholics or those outside the Catholic Church, Christians from other denominations, say, would see the priest at the front acting at the altar on a Sunday morning and the priest doing all these different things and the priest in charge of all these things. A culture has grown up in a sense, certainly not in every parish, but in a number of parishes, and just in a culture, in the larger Catholic culture, maybe of the priest being the one who's meant to do everything in a parish, and then
oh, they're the professionals, you know. If you really wanted to be Christian, you would be a priest or religious, right? That's what you would be, and yet that's not what you would be, right? No. We're told to evangelize the culture. We're told to establish the kingdom, and that's what we're doing. Maybe badly, maybe weakly, maybe we need a lot of improvement, a lot of support. We do, but we're there to do it together, and we're there to establish a civilization of life and love. And when we fail, we should own it quickly. And when somebody else fails, we should forgive it just as quickly and move on. But we move on together. We move on from our original blessedness through the fallenness. And we all experience what that fallenness is. I think the one thing that nobody has trouble believing is that there's evil in the world. That's easy, right? That's easy. But redemption, you know, to live as the redeemed, what does that look like? What does that actually look like? And it looks like fully developing your gifts, fully developing, and fully calling out the gifts of others. You know, that's something I think we kind of sometimes fail to do. We get a little competitive. And we don't want to necessarily call out the gifts of others because they may be better than ours. Oh, praise God. Hopefully they are better than ours,
yeah,
right?
Exactly. Hopefully they are. You know, what you're bringing forward here and what this picture I'm forming in my mind here is of this just church where the priest lorded the power over the people, and you see this as a very male-centered hierarchy, but what it's meant to be, what you're fleshing out here for me as I'm thinking through this with you is, no, if we all begin to embrace our gifts and encourage others to embrace our gifts, the whole body of Catholics rises up to augment the work of the priest at the altar. Is that a good way of seeing it?
Correct. Yeah, exactly. And we're complementary, right? We have a complementarity between male and female. We have a complementarity between clergy and lay. We have a complementarity with those who are capable of contributing and those who are on the receiving end, you know. And yet, that's the beauty of it all. That's what makes it oneness, right? And the oneness of God ought to be reflected in the church. We ought to be one and live as one and have a common life. And that's what's difficult to build when we're very focused on what we're doing rather than who we are. I think that's a big distraction, because as soon as we do that, we start to value ourselves for what we can contribute. And there's no difference between that. You know, if I can contribute, you know, a nice song at communion meditation, that's a lovely thing. But if my value comes from that, it's not any different than saying that my value comes from how much money is in my bank account. It's what I possess and what I can do. Those things are not who we are. We are not means to an end. We are, each one of us, an end, and we're to be loved, not used. And that's the difference, right? That's the difference. So if we are to be like God, we don't use each other, we love each other. And that means calling forth the best in each other. It means holding ourselves accountable and sometimes holding each other accountable. But it also means recognizing the giftedness that men are and the giftedness that women are. And it's not the same gift, nor does it have to be. Why would you want it to be? It makes it just so much more interesting, right? It's a different experience to go to a woman doctor than it is to go to a male doctor. It's just a different experience. It's not that one doctor is better than another. It's not that one doctor is preferable or whatever. But it's that it's different. And the difference is the diversity we say we cherish and value. So, you know, that's part of it, right? And then, of course, too, when we destroy stereotypes, we say a woman is not someone who bakes cookies, homeschools, 14 children, and lives on a farm, and, you know, and takes care of elderly parents, and that's what a woman is. Some women are that, and some women are meant to be that. They're called to be that. It's who they are. It's not what they do. Other women are, you know, somewhere on a corporate, in a corner office. Some are lawyers. Some are teachers. Some are homeless. Some are addicts. Some, you know, it's the range of who we are. And so I think when we talk gender, we multiply stereotypes and we just call people to stereotypes instead of to the giftedness of who they are and the uniqueness of who they were created to be.
That's very well said. And, you know, as a male who is currently the stay-at-home parent for this part of our family's stage of life, it's very affirming to, and I talked to Dr. Abigail Favalli a while back on the show about the issue in particular of gender and feminism in the church, and she said very similar things to what you're saying, and it's always very affirming to hear. It's so refreshing and so different from what larger society presents to us when thinking about men and women and gender roles and what we do, right? And how different that is from what the Catholic faith would have us understand.
Absolutely. And that's the fullness, right? You know, we're little buds, you know, we're flowers that are still in bud stage. And the point of divine love is to bring us into full blossom. We never do that if we're aspiring for somebody, you know, to be a something else, someone else, or that we somehow feel we fall short of who we are. It's impossible to fall short of who we are because no one else is you. You know, we can only be who we were created to be, and that's a one-of-a-kind, unique person. But the beautiful thing about that is it's not just genetics. It's not just biology. It's not just DNA. It's that we are created body and soul, because that's the unique reality of human existence, right? We're created body and soul for a unique fingerprint, one-of-a-kind holiness. A unique fingerprint, one-of-a-kind love. And each one of us, God loves each one of us, and we return love to God in a completely unique and individual way, so that, you know, however many people have ever existed in the history of humankind, that's how many ways we can be holy, and that's how many ways we can love God and one another.
Okay, so I have one last question for you, because I've met non-Catholic Christians, I've spoken to them, I've received their emails and feedback, and they often see a real problem with this exclusively male hierarchy. They might point to something as nefarious as the abuse crisis in the church as symptomatic, but there are many more subtle difficulties as well. You know, that missing feminine voice at the decision-making table, for example. You know, we've addressed some of this already, but I wonder if you can now speak directly to that person who might see Catholicism as a live option, as something maybe even deeply attractive, but just can't get over the idea that all of our clerics are male. What would you say to somebody from your own personal perspective, somebody looking into Catholicism, but somebody who finds the role of women in the faith to be wanting?
Look at the saints. Just look at the saints. You know, we love our priests, and they have an office of service, and they bring Jesus to us in Holy Eucharist. But look at the saints. Look at the great variety that they are, and see yourself as one of them. You know, it's never a question about of what office you held. The Blessed Virgin Mary in her lifetime, right? We don't know anything about a healing miracle or an out of body bilocating experience, and we don't have records of her levitating. We don't have any of that, and yet she is the single most honored person in the church. And we call her the Queen of all saints, and the Queen of heaven, the Queen of earth, Queen of all of the angels, right? And we see her that way because her relationship with Jesus Christ exalted her. That's what the church is meant to give you. And being a priest or a deacon or a sister, religious sister or brother or someone married, or it has nothing to do with that. You were created for one-of-a-kind holiness, and God will open the doors and make all of that holiness possible. He never asks us to do something that's impossible or that's something he does not equip. And so it's going to be a call to the priesthood. For me, it's not. And it becomes very simple. I don't have to discern like any man would have to discern whether I should be a priest, right? I know I should not. And it's okay for me to not be a priest because my priest can never be a mother. It's fine. I wouldn't exchange that for anything. And so it's who we are, who we are. But if that whole kind of power structure, and that's how you see it, bothers you, then start asking why you would ever see the priesthood of Jesus Christ as a power structure. And start thinking about what could you do to make it what it was meant to be, and to encourage priests and bishops to be what they are called to be. I know I need help to be what I'm called to be. They do too. They mess up and I mess up. And I often mess up considerably worse than they do, But lend your voice, but also look at things with an open mind and an open heart, and let God instruct you because he will. And, maybe consider reading Lumen Gentium. That's the dogmatic constitution on the church. That was a Vatican II document that really kind of talks about what the church is and who the church is. There's this kind of Petrine profile, this kind of idea of Peter and the apostles and all of that, that structure, that institutional church, and we need it. And there's also that Marian profile of tenderness, of love, of the home, of unleashing the gifts within others, of prayer, of intercession, and of being a handmaid to the Lord and a helper, an advocate for others. So there are both of those things, and they have their place. And there's a place for you. There's a place for every person in the church. And the church is poorer without you. And so if you, maybe it's the last thing you think you'd ever want to be. That's where I was. But after a long time, I can say it was the best decision I ever made, was to become Catholic. It utterly transformed my life in 100,000,000,000 wonderful ways. And it's eventually transforming me. And that's a good thing, too, because I needed to be changed. So, grace meets us where we are. It never conflicts with nature, right? But it perfects nature. And that's the beauty of being in the fullness of faith. Not that we all live it perfectly. We don't. We fail miserably. But just because we fail the ideal doesn't mean the ideal was wrong. That's the key. Trying to do the right thing, I fail. That thing is still the right thing. So I've fallen short. So what do? Do I beat myself over the head? No. I lick my wounds, I get up, and try again.
That's fantastic. Listen, this has been an absolutely wonderful conversation to have. I appreciate your time. I think listeners to this program will really enjoy your perspective and this discussion. I hope it'll be illuminating. I hope it'll be insightful and edifying. Where could people go to find out more about what you're up to, what you're doing, and check out more of your stuff?
Oh, yeah. So they could go to loavesandfishesministry.net. But they could also go to Facebook and friend me on Facebook. Take a look at, I usually post my columns there and also on Twitter. On Twitter, I'm at YouFeedThem, because that's the loaves and fishes command, right? You feed them. You only have 5 loaves and 2 fish, but you feed them. So anyway, and keep a look out at Ave Maria Press, because we're always doing great things and great books, great authors. And, you know, that's a privilege, right, to help people tell their stories, to help people bring their gifts to the table and influence others and console others by the experience that they've had by grace.
That's fantastic. Thank you so much for being on the show. I appreciate your time. God bless you. God bless your family. And God bless the wonderful work you are doing for the church. Thank
Amen.
You so much. Thank you for listening to this episode of The Cordial Catholic. I hope you enjoyed that fantastic discussion. Hopefully you learned something new. Hopefully that gave you a good taste of what authentic Catholic teaching on women in the church actually is. That's the whole goal. Visit The Cordial Catholic for show notes, including links to Jamie's website and articles and things she's written there as well. I'm at Cordial Catholic on Twitter, The Cordial Catholic on Facebook, and cordialcatholic@gmail.com is where you can send any of your email feedback. I love hearing from you guys and love your feedback. It helps me to continue to improve this show. So please do reach out over email, cordialcatholic@gmail.com. Please subscribe to or follow this show wherever you find it. Please leave ratings and reviews if you can as well. Those ratings and reviews help push this podcast out to new people and honestly helps me to expand the mission of evangelization that undergirds this entire thing. Thanks so much for those already leaving reviews and ratings, and please do take a moment and help us to reach more people. If you want to support this show financially, even $1 or $2 a month goes a long way. That's at patreon.com/cordialcatholic and gives you access to a special behind-the-scenes show. Any funds that come into the show, honestly, folks, helps me to devote more time to doing it. I appreciate that so much, and thanks to those already sponsoring the show. Have a great week, guys. Talk to you next week, and God bless. This show is brought to you in a special way by our co-producer patrons over at patreon.com/cordialcafe. A special thanks to Ellie and Tom, Kelvin and Susan, Stephen, Suzanne and Victor, Phil, Noah, Nicole, Michelle, Jordan, John, James, Gina, and Aram for your special support at the co-producer tier and making this thing possible. You guys are fantastic. God bless and thanks for your support.